For the week of January 15th, 2012, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 132, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And trapped in a New York City subway, I'm Michael Giltz.
Now, why are you trapped in a New York City subway?
Because the New York City subway system is broken. It's unbelievable. It's just a nightmare. For the next 3 months, the one subway train in my neighborhood will not be running on the weekends. Every time you go anywhere in the city, you hear that train's not running. This train isn't running. That's local. That's express. It's a nightmare.
Yeah, I can
it's
only
really,
imagine.
Really bad. Years of neglect and the recession have really taken its toll. The subway system is not in good shape right now.
Now, it is one of the most extensive subway systems in the world, next to Paris.
Absolutely. Oh, it's bigger than Paris by far.
Well, right. And whenever people say to me, oh, you live in Los Angeles, you know, where we talk about a subway in Los Angeles, people will always say, oh, it's impossible. It's just too spread out. There's no way to build a subway. And I always go back to and tell them, look, in 1906, there were two subway lines in New York. And now look.
Exactly.
It takes time. And, you know, 1906 to 1925, I think, a lot of those lines were put in. So they are, you know, getting to be 100 years old. It's time to do some maintenance.
Exactly.
And it's also time for our show. Well, actually, we have a little bit of a treat. We've been threatening to bring John Fithian, the head of the National Association of Theater Owners, on the show for a long time to discuss long-term box office trends. And guess what? He's going to be on the show today. Of course, NATO is a trade group which represents cinema operators, so he should have a lot to say about that. We'll also talk a little bit about the Golden Globes, where, let's face it, the story wasn't necessarily who won awards, but which stars were ribbed by host Ricky Gervais. We'll also give you a brief update on two anti-piracy bills making their way through Congress. Last week, the Obama administration weighed in on them. Of course, we'll cover some of the big entertainment headlines during Big Deal or Big Whoop. Who knows how long we'll run with Mr. Fithian? We'll have to see. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
Well, the weekend box office figures are for North America because of the holiday weekend and the short shrift that international box office gets from most other outlets. We simply don't have the figures. The Variety and Hollywood Reporter and some of our other sources simply have not posted their stories yet detailing what the overseas box office was like for the weekend. It wasn't a holiday overseas, so I'm not quite sure what the delay is, but if they don't put the numbers up, we can't put it all together and add the figures and give you the worldwide box office. We're virtually the only ones who do it on a regular basis. And this week, our hands are tied, I'm afraid to say. But it was a very good weekend at the North American box office. The number one film in the country was Contraband over the four-day weekend. It grossed $28 million. And that means the movie made more than its budget of $25 million in just one day. That's the Mark Wahlberg thriller. Number two is Beauty and the Beast, the Disney reissue of that film in 3D. It grossed $23 million, which makes it the highest grossing debut for an animated film in January history. Of course, almost no animated films get debuted in January.
I was going to say, it also might make it the only animated debut.
Well, the Hoodwinked 2 came out in January to, I think, like $16 million. So this beat that. There have been some films, but very few. Number three at the box office in North America was Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol. That grossed $14 million. It's at $189 million in North America and counting. And number four is Joyful Noise, the church choir movie starring Queen Latifah and Dolly Parton and Jeremy Jordan of Broadway's Newsies. That grossed $13.7 million.
Oh, that's right. It's official now. Jeremy Jordan is in Newsies now, right?
That's right.
So you were right. You were right the whole time.
Everybody knew that. Okay. And number five is Sherlock Holmes, A Game of Shadows. It grossed another $10 million. It's at $172 million and counting. And number six is The Devil Inside, last week's number one movie, which, as everybody expected, had a, you know, historic drop, 72% drop. It grossed $9 million, though. Some people still went to see it. It's at $47 million and counting. Not bad for a movie that costs less than $1 million for Paramount to pick up. And number seven is The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. It grossed another $8 million. It's at $89 million in counting, so it will pass $100 million, but this is not a success. And number eight, Alvin and the Chipmunks, Chipwrecked. People are still going to see it. It grossed $7.8 million. It's at $120 million and counting. Number nine, Steven Spielberg's War Horse, which has been slow but steady. It grossed $7 million. It's at $67 million and counting. And that's on a budget of maybe $65, $66 million. So it has now made back its budget in North America, at least in grosses. And number 10, is We Bought a Zoo, the Matt Damon film, $6.8 million. And right behind it is The Iron Lady, the Meryl Streep film, for which she just won a Golden Globe for Best Actress. That expanded to 800 screens. It grossed $6.4 million and just missed being in the top 10. But it's a nice, solid expansion for this art house project. And number 12, The Adventures of Tintin, $5.2 million. It's slowing down now. It's at $68 million. This movie will not gross $100 million in North America. And I don't care how much you make overseas. That is a big disappointment for a film like this from director Steven Spielberg.
Well, I would imagine War Horse is a big disappointment.
It is. I saw The Descendants over the weekend. I saw The Iron Lady. And I saw Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. I loved Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. I was indifferent to The Descendants, though I like George Clooney. And The Iron Lady is strictly Meryl Streep. It's not a movie that's worthy of her or her talents. It's just kind of turns a fascinating, complex, and if the movie was well-made, frustrating person like Margaret Thatcher, who should just be magnetic, and makes her kind of dull.
Well, last week, and I'm just going to go back to War Horse here for a second, because last week we talked about M.T. Carney might step down from Disney as the head of marketing. Well, that's it turns right out that very day she did step down. She sent out an email saying goodbye. There was some talk about the fact that maybe Steven Spielberg didn't appreciate or didn't like the way she marketed War Horse, which I think most people would say at $67 million isn't exactly going gangbusters. But by the end of the week, they had hired Ricky Strauss to come in and take her place.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I know that the campaign, they switched in the middle. They had a poster with the horse and the boy, the handsome young man who was Joey, the guy who loved his horse. And at some point they said, no, it tests better if we just use the horse. And they switched it back. Can you imagine being the lead actor in a film and they take you off the poster because people just want to look at the horse? But that was one of the midstream changes that they made. I'm not quite sure about that. I certainly wouldn't blame her for that because the movie got polite reviews. It got some nice reviews, much better than I would have expected. But, you know, it's just not a successful movie anywhere in the world, much less here. But
well, right. And they brought in, you know, speaking of switching horses midstream, they went from M.T. Carney, who had no movie experience, to Ricky Strauss, who has spent, you know, close to 16, 17 years as a marketing and production executive over at Sony. So they're going with kind of a trusted hand there.
And a good looking guy. So if he wants to come on the show, invite him away.
Now, let me ask you, did you like The Descendants?
I did not. It was intelligent. It was well made. It was fine. It's very typical to the other Alexander Payne films he's made in the last few years. But I just was bored. I was not interested. I didn't care. It was nothing that I vehemently disliked. There were intelligent performances in it, but the story itself simply never held my attention.
Well, did the Golden Globes hold your attention? Because The Descendants won Best Drama.
That's right. The Descendants won Best Drama and The Artist won Best Comedy. So those two movies get a certain sense of momentum as we go into the Oscars, though The Artist really has a long row to hoe if it's going to win Best Picture because it has very little box office momentum. It's not steamrolling into a big commercial hit. It's only on a couple hundred screens right now, and it's doing well. It grossed $1.4 million this weekend.
And only 216 screens, so.
Right. Well, yes, but that's, you know, it's reflecting the amount of demand as well. It's not like people are flocking, you know, to see it. But it's hit $9 million. It's doing well. It's a good, solid art house hit. But it would, you know, be the second year in a row, I think, or the third, you know, second out of 3 years where we'd have a really low grossing movie become the best picture of the year. That's not typically what happens.
Kind of like the Hurt Locker.
Right. The highest grossing and the lowest grossing movies of the year rarely, if ever, become, you know, the best picture winner. They tend to like solid, strong hits, but not, don't make too much money, but don't make too much little either.
Well, I don't think there are any solid true hits this year that you could root for. I mean, I find... Well,
The Help was a big hit.
Okay, besides The Help, but...
Midnight in Paris was Woody Allen's biggest hit of his career, and those two are definitely in the hunt for Best Picture, I think.
Yes, I would agree, as is The Descendants, and as is Hugo. And looking at, you know, you had Martin Scorsese win for Hugo, so he won Best Director, and then you had The Artist win, as you mentioned, for Best Musical or Comedy. And I don't know, watching the Golden Globes last night, I couldn't help but think that somehow Hollywood has become somewhat self-referential this year. You have Hugo, a movie about movie making, and The Artist, a movie about movie making, winning awards.
And My Week with Marilyn.
My Week with Marilyn. And Michelle Williams won Best Actress for a Musical or Comedy. And, you know, it's all about, you know, these are all films that center around filmmaking in some way.
It was always thus. Theater people love musicals and shows about theater. Movie people love movies about movies, especially when they're well made. And in television, the big thing that struck me was that every award went to a show that was on cable except for Modern Family and Best Comedy.
Yes.
Every other show, Showtime, Homeland, Claire Danes, Laura Dern in Enlightened, Matt LeBlanc in Episodes, Downton Abbey on PBS, Kate Winslet in HBO's Mildred Pierce, Idris Elba's in Luther, on and on and on. The network is simply not a player on television anymore.
Well, the Golden Globes are handed out by the Hollywood Foreign Press Association. This is a group of about 90, 95 journalists from around the world. Each country gets a representative on the on the jury there. And, you know,
I could represent Bermuda.
Well, there you go. You should write in.
But the trend is reflected in the Emmys as well.
Right. Well,
you know, for drama and miniseries that the major networks are not players.
Right. They're almost playing it too safe. I think people are a little bit edgier. And guess what? Shows on cable are a little bit edgier. So, you know, they're a little bit more to people's liking.
And they and the Emmys really need to change the rules as far as miniseries. It's absurd that Downton Abbey won Best Miniseries. It's absurd that Idris Elba, a terrific actor, won Best Actor in a Miniseries for Luther. They're not miniseries. They're ongoing series. We all know it. It's not that hard to figure it out.
Yeah, when you come back for a second season, you're not a miniseries, FYI.
Well, miniseries do have sequels, but it's just a different beast, and it's not an – you know when they're being renewed before the first season is even ended. Well, it's not a miniseries. That complicated.
Were you surprised by Best Screenplay went to Woody Allen for Midnight in Paris? Surprised by that?
No, I mean, I don't think he deserves it, but certainly not. I mean, he could win the Oscar for Best Original Screenplay.
Original Song, Masterpiece, which Madonna co-wrote. Were you surprised by that?
I'm not surprised by anything the Golden Globes would do, whether good or ill. I saw the trailer for Wallace and Edward, which is what it stands for. It was tagged along, of course, to the trailer to the movie The Iron Lady. This is a film about the great romance of the royalty where he left the throne for the woman he loved. And there is the movie, and we see the trailer. It looks fine. It's British. Anglophiles will like it. And at the end, it says directed by Madonna, and to which I say, more power to you.
Well, and I guess watching the show last night, of course, the big news, as I mentioned at the top of the show, was Ricky Gervais was brought back for a third time. He was going to host the Golden Globes. Last year, he offended everybody, apparently. But
that was his job.
That was his job. And this year, while walking in, everybody said, oh, no, it's all a joke. And, you know, you have to take it in good fun. Well, you could sense that when they would cut to the audience, people were like, you know, cringing, waiting for the next possible joke that was going to be thrown out. And I don't know, he was a little bit more tame. I'd say a lot more tame this year than he has been in years past.
Well, you know, if the ratings are strong, and I think they were solid compared to the year before, they'll probably invite him back again. He'll just run out of ways to insult them.
That's true. Well, and I thought the whole thing with Johnny Depp, he brings Johnny Depp out and asks him if he's seen his own movie. That was kind of funny.
I didn't watch it.
Oh, you didn't watch?
I only watch the Oscars, the Grammys, the Emmys, and the Tonys. Well, I don't watch all the small fry. I can't be bothered. American People Award, American Music Awards, the country music, I don't have time.
Okay, well, you know, I guess if you had watched it, you would have, in my opinion, noticed a little bit of the whole insidery feeling of it. You know, Brad Pitt introducing The Descendants, the George Clooney movie. George Clooney introducing Moneyball, a Brad Pitt movie. And of course, they're both friends, so... You know,
they do that at the Oscars as well.
Yeah, exactly. But I want to know, is there a law that Harrison Ford has to give out a Best Picture award at every award show? Because he did it again last night. He does it at the Oscars. He did it for the Golden Globes. I don't get it.
Well, he's a beloved Hollywood star. At one point, he was the biggest box office star in history. More films in the top 10 grossing movies of all time or top 20 than any other star. So, you know, he's a big major Hollywood star.
Yeah, I guess when you put it that way, it makes sense.
Star Wars and Indiana Jones. What more can the man do?
Well, if you haven't seen the Golden Globes, then there's really no use riffing on Ricky Gervais and whether he was more or less tactful last night than the year before. So maybe we should move along and speak with John Fithian, the president of the National Association of Theater Owners. Now, this is a trade group that represents movie theater owners, really, to politicians and to the public.
And we've wanted him on for a while. I want to talk to him about the quality of the movie-going experience, the long-term trends of ticket sales and box office and how the theaters are doing and what they can do to make it even better.
Yes, indeed. And he is somebody I always enjoy speaking with. So, Mr. Fithian, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Sperling. Glad to be on board.
Well, John, we wanted to talk to you because for years I've been covering the entertainment industry and movies in particular, and I get in debates with people all the time when they look at, say, like 2010 and say, oh my gosh, this year is down at the box office compared to 2009. And I say, well, 2009 was the biggest year in history. 2010 is the second biggest year in history as far as pure box office grosses. That doesn't sound like the sky is falling to me. And when I keep pointing to long-term trends about ticket sales and box office grosses and how they've increased steadily over the past three or four decades, keeping pace with the population growth, and I try to tell people, no, movie going is a very popular thing that's held very steady and been very strong for many, many years, despite all the new things like the internet and DVDs and streaming video. So I just want you to help us put into perspective that individual years' ups and downs don't necessarily reflect the long-term trends where you look at ticket sales and box office from the 70s to the 80s to the 90s to the noughts, you know, Hollywood's doing very well, and NATO is one big reason why.
Well, I appreciate that, and your analysis is very, very apt. I mean, we often have to contend with mass media reporter questions about the strength of the theatrical box office, and our response is very much to compare the short term with the long term, because in the short term, our business is really cyclical and driven primarily by the commercial viability of the movies that are distributed to us, as well as the distribution patterns. You know, are all the genres covered, all the movies spread out well throughout the 12 months, or are they bunched, or are they just targeting a certain part of the demographic? And so we have, in the short term, a lot of volatility in our grosses. If you look at the year that we just completed, for example, the first quarter was a disaster. I think we were down about 22% in January through March of 2011. But then the movies came back and we jumped right back up and we set a record in the second quarter and the third quarter, had a record-breaking summer, highest box office ever for a summer period. And then the fourth quarter was down again. So by the end of the year, we ended up about 3.5 percentage points down on box office and probably somewhere just under 5% down on admissions. And so we view that year as the typical roller coaster in the short term. Now, in the longer term, your question aptly describes what the trends are like, because we go decade by decade. And from the 1970s to the decade that we just completed, we grew on average about 200 million admissions per year on average throughout those decades. And what does that mean? It means the decade we just completed, we averaged about 1.5 billion admissions. It was about 1.3 in the 90s and 1.1 in the 80s and just a little over 900 million per year in the 70s. So the long-term trends are indeed for growth, you know, in every decade. Now, I guess the last thing I'll say is the most recent challenge has been, well, yes, NATO, but the admissions in 2011 were the lowest they've been for 16 years. Well, you know, that is correct. Only if you take 1 year in isolation and compare it to, you know, to the long-term trends, do you get a result like that. You really have to look at all the years together and the effects of short-term versus long-term production. And just one more little thing here. I'm always amused by the critics that say that the theatrical marketplace is dying because all the teenage boys are going home to play video games and hang out on the internet. And last year, 2011, was kind of bad for everybody, and it was not as bad for us as it was for other forms of entertainment. I mean, video game sales were down 8% last year. You know, DVD sales were down for the fifth year in a row. So you have to put it all in context of short-term versus long-term, and then you have to see what else is happening in the economy and the marketplace and realize that the theatrical business is pretty robust and will continue to grow over the long term.
Well, you know, I don't think necessarily that movie theaters are in decline or that the motion picture theatrical market is down and out, so to speak. But Michael and I debate on this show all the time whenever I bring up or suggest that there are per capita declines year over year, and that is the number of times a person goes to a movie in a movie theater going down year over year. And I guess I'm really referring to the last decade, 2000 to 2010, which was really the first decade where the internet was in existence for the full decade. And I guess really between piracy and the fracturing of the public's attention to all these other forms of entertainment, it seems to me that there's this younger generation out there that really doesn't go to movies. And my fear as somebody who loves movies is that we're not making movie going more of a habit and part of the culture.
Well, I might have a fear of that if the numbers bore that out, but I added up the numbers, the hard numbers, and in the 90s, we sold 12.96 billion tickets in the North American box office, and the gross was about $52 billion. In the 2000s, the first decade of the internet, we sold 14.46 billion tickets. That's another 1.6 billion tickets averaged out over the decade, and the gross was $91 billion. So the box office increased almost 100%, about 80%, 85%, something like that. It's a natural reflection of population growth, of course, and inflation and all things like that. But box office is at very least keeping steady with the population growth and inflation when you look at it in the long term.
That's good data, Michael. And I would add in, kind of an analysis of the demographics that we're confronting. It is true, Sperling, that if you look at the first part of a decade ago, there were some years in which there was a greater frequency of attendance than there have been in the last year or two. 2002 was a huge year. 2004 was a good year. And then 2005 was way down. And then you have some more roller coaster rides from there on out. So your question, you know, is this a long-term trend with the last couple of years being a little bit down in admissions, or is it just a continuation of the roller coaster that we've seen throughout our history? And I'm fairly confident it's the latter. And there are a couple demographic trends, particularly in the United States, which are really important to look at. These don't translate to the rest of the world, of course. But if you look at who goes to the movies the most often, it's the Hispanics. Our Hispanic Americans go about 7 times a year compared to roughly 4 for the rest of the population. And that is also the fastest growing part of the population. Hispanics make up about 1 out of 5 or 1 out of 6 Americans today. And by 2050, they'll make up about 1 out of 3. So the people that go to the movies the most often are also the part of the population that's growing the fastest. And that's good news for us. It's not very good news for Europe because their population is declining overall. And the people that don't go to the movies very often are the ones that are having the babies. So not quite as good a story in Europe. But here in the United States, we're pretty bullish on what the demographic trends are going forward.
Well, yeah, I guess my concern and really what I'm referring to and speaking about is this younger generation that more and more doesn't really believe that you should pay for music or doesn't understand that you have to pay for music and that it wasn't always free on the internet. And this really the same goes for movies, that you're supposed to pay to go to a movie theater or buy the DVD. And I guess my fear is that over time, little by little, that this will chip away at the per capita and the number of times people actually go to a movie theater to see a movie.
Well, we have, but you've raised something that is actually more concerning to me than the other arguments that we hear in the popular press. I mean, most of the arguments we hear in the popular press are teenagers don't want to go to the movies anymore. They have too much to do at home. And I don't think that is our danger. But you mentioned, you know, the desire of this generation to experience their entertainment for free. And that is a challenge to us. We don't feel challenged by entertainment in the home versus entertainment in the cinemas. But we do feel challenged by piracy, by movie theft, by, you know, the inclination of some to watch their entertainment for free, be it movies or television or songs or what have you. And that is a real threat to us. We estimate that we lose about $600 million a year, maybe more, in ticket sales to piracy right now. And that number is only going to increase as the penetration of broadband increases, as more and more people learn how to do streaming on the net. And so we're spending a lot of resources at the National Association of Theater Owners tackling movie theft at its source, you know, camcording and in seeking tougher legislation, because that is a real challenge to us. You know, when you give up more than $500 million a year to pirates, that stymies growth. So we have to get rid of that.
Yeah, and the one concern I have, well, one of several concerns, is the movie-going experience. Now, I grew up in the 70s, and believe me, movies are so much better than the theaters of the 70s and the multiplexes of the early 80s. It was a terrible movie-going experience back then. Poor sound, theaters chopped up into smaller theaters with sound bleeding from one theater to another. Today, we have so many amenities like stadium seating and cup holders and multiplexes. You can actually go see a movie on opening weekend with just the minimal planning. It's almost the ability to expand the theaters to meet demand is really remarkable now. And that's all very much to the positive. And we know there are new challenges like cell phones and texting and things like that, that theaters always need to keep an eye on and work on to prevent. But I'm worried that we're turning movie going into an expensive event. Obviously, people are not rejecting 3D movies because 6 out of the top 10 films of the last year were 3D films. They counted, I think, for like $1.5 billion in box office. We just see Beauty and the Beast opening this weekend, a movie that's how many decades old and opened to $24, $25 million, the biggest, you know, opening weekend in January for an animated film in history. Clearly, people like 3D. They like to go see Mission Impossible in IMAX, and that's all great. But the movie-going experience is becoming more of an event rather than a regular thing you do. I think we hear a lot from families when they take their kids to movies, and maybe bring the neighbor's kid, and they got to pay a premium of $2 or $3 to see a 3D film. Suddenly, yeah, they go to the movie, but then they don't go again next week, or they don't go again 2 or 3 weeks later. Maybe they decide to just rent a DVD or do something else. And I'm worried that the iMac, what we're getting to is a period where we're creating it as a premium event that does something you can't do at home. That's great. But it's so expensive, it becomes something that is not, you know, an everyday thing that you would do casually.
Right, right. Well, there are two really good points there. I mean, one is the improved movie-going experience over the last couple of decades, which you correctly described. And the second is, you know, the price point for the tickets and what the average American believes is appropriate there. And those can be themes in conflict, if you will. I mean, we have spent a lot of money upgrading cinemas, and you're right. They're not like your dad's cinema-going experience. Stadium seating was expensive, digital sound systems. Now digital cinema, we're about 65% integrated with digital cinema here in the United States. You guys are going to have to change, you know, Celluloid Junkie to something else soon because we're digitizing. But all that, you know, comes at great cost. It expands and improves the experience. The sight lines are better. The visual image is better. The sound's better. You know, you point out that 3D is a value add from digital cinema. So all that improves the experience. But it also comes at a significant cost, and so the ticket prices, you know, have gone up. But I would put the rise in ticket prices in context, because if you look over the past 40 years, if you compare ticket prices in 1971 to the ticket prices in 2011, our increases are actually slightly less than the cost than the rise in inflation over that time period. So we're staying on a track that we hope is affordable for the average consumer. Now, the last point you make, though, what is the premium experience price, and does that possibly reduce the frequency rate of going to the movies? And that's important to us. You know, the IMAX, the big screen experiences come at a price. 3D is more expensive than 2D, and that's, you know, that's concomitant with the experience. But it's my belief, and I argue this case to the studios all the time. It's my belief that we have to keep offering choices to our consumers in the experience and in the price point. I don't want, for example, 3D-only movies. I don't want movies that are being released that you can only see in 3D and have to pay the premium price for it, because there are some consumers, some families, that prefer the lower price point and still want to go see the 2D show. So as long as we offer the tiers, you know, the 2Ds, the 3Ds, the large screen formats, the matinees, the children's ticket prices, those kinds of options, I think will continue to be an affordable form of entertainment for people kind of in all income brackets.
Yeah, 3D. 3D costs more for to movies to be made. It costs more to convert them, and it costs more to display them in theaters. The same was true for color and for sound and for widescreen Panavision. All these innovations came out. You paid a premium to see them at first, but ultimately now, today, we do not pay extra for color or sound or widescreen movie images or, you know, anything like that. Can you envision a day? And this is, of course, a big conflict between NATO and the studios. The studios have pushed you to make all these expensive innovations, but they want you to carry the burden of providing 3D glasses. Can you envision a day where 3D would not cost extra, just like color or sound or widescreen?
A couple really important questions in there. I don't envision a day where 3D and 2D is the same price, although I could easily be wrong. And the reason for that is that we're going to continue to offer, I hope, the option. Whereas the other innovations that you described became relatively quickly ubiquitous. In other words, once we went to color, everything was color. Once we had sound, everything was sound. I guess you could say, with the exception of, you know, what the artist this year, but everything has those innovations in them. So digital 3D is a little bit different. I personally hope that the prices aren't standardized, because I think we need to offer choices. Finding the right range where consumers come and enjoy the experience and appreciate is always a challenge, and the companies do that week by week. The second thing you mentioned, which is kind of a hot button issue for us, is the cost of the glasses. And that was an issue raised relatively recently by Sony Pictures when they almost unilaterally announced that they were going to completely change the business model and stop paying for 3D glasses, which many of our members kind of rejected to very, very quickly. And the reason for it is this. I mean, when we developed this whole digital cinema revolution, we as an industry did it cooperatively, rather historically, I might add. If you think about the digital sound debates when we had four different systems and no one could get their act together, the fact that the studios and the equipment companies and the exhibitors came together around common technical standards and common business models for digital cinema is really a historic achievement. Part of that understanding was the 3D component. And the way it works is this. Studios pay to either make or convert the movies into 3D, and they pay for the glasses. Exhibitors pay for the extra equipment and cost at the exhibition end of showing the movie in 3D. Even though the digital projectors are shared costs, the added equipment that goes along with 3D is all on the exhibitor, okay? And the labor costs of dealing with the stuff and the glasses are all on the exhibitor. So that was the understanding. And so when one studio comes along and unilaterally announces, oh, we're changing this, it didn't fly very well. And you know, we'll see how that pans out. The summer movies for Sony are coming, and they'll have to work it out before the summer kind of happens.
Well, now, on this idea of choice and of ticket price, you know, there was an article in the Atlantic Monthly just a week or two ago about how all ticket prices for all movies cost the same. Do you ever envision a time where maybe an independent film costs a little bit less, the ticket for it, that is, and going to see Mission Impossible 9 might cost more?
Really, really difficult question. And you know, I should add on this and kind of all the pricing questions that these are decisions that our members make individually. They set their prices how they want. You know, we don't encourage or try to standardize that. If we did, we'd go to jail because the antitrust laws forbid it. So this is all kind of theoretical talk on my part, and companies right. make up their own decisions. I personally think that differentiated pricing model based on the movies would be a disaster in the long term, because you're essentially saying any low priced movie isn't any good. And you're betting, gambling that the high priced movie is good. And one thing we know is what we don't know in this business. And that is, until Friday night, when they start putting down their money at the box office and buying tickets, we really don't know what we've got. You know, we can do this sophisticated tracking, and we can make projections and assess the marketing spends, but we really don't know what we've got until we've got. And there are more surprises out there than there are predictable commercial results. And I would be very nervous that we'd take a movie that no one thinks is going to do a ton of business. You know, we'd take a Bridesmaids or a Help or, you know, any number of movies like that and say, oh, this is probably going to be a $30 million movie, so we'll just charge, you know, a lesser amount for it. And then it turns out to be, you know, one of the biggest movies of the season. So that's the danger of variable pricing.
You never know where the surprise is going to come, like the devil inside. But when one talks about price options, I don't think people need the price option to pay more for a movie. They'd be perfectly happy if 3D movies did not cost extra. And the fact is that every other weekend, at least throughout the next year, there's a big movie coming out in 3D. So it does not feel like it's some special new thing, unlike, say, you know, unlike color and sound, which is on every movie. Frankly, it feels like every week there's a 3D movie. And I know I resent having to pay extra. It's not fair to you, but that's the way it is. And yeah. It gets harder and harder to find a theater where 2D is playing. And sometimes you want to see it in 3D because that's the way it was really, really meant to be seen. But you still resent paying the extra money. So it's a difficult issue. And the economics and looking at long-term pricing of tickets doesn't really play into that emotional decision that people make, where they pay for it, they go to see it, but they sort of resent it. And maybe they don't go back the following week.
Did you resent paying the extra money for Avatar?
Oh, God, yes.
Oh, I didn't. No, you see, that. And
I resented seeing Avatar at all.
Well, you are a very unique person, because I will tell you that your concern about price points on 3D is something we hear all the time, but I will tell you that the number of complaints we got about the price point on Avatar were minuscule compared to how big that movie was.
Absolutely, and that was a breakthrough. And nowadays, so many movies come out in 3D, where Avatar was really, you know, when it hadn't happened in a long time, or you go see your first IMAX film, you're excited by it. But the more and more that happens, the less, you know, enamored you are with the idea that it's a big new thing, and it becomes part of the average movie-going experience, whether it's, you know, Journey to the Center of the Earth or the Star Wars Episode One, The Phantom Menace, reconfigured, or Titanic in a few weeks, or every animated film that comes out that your children want to see is all in 3D and costs this extra $2 or $3 a movie. It becomes a burden.
It does, but I'll tell you, I I believe if we keep offering the choice, and you earlier in your question, you made a good point, which was sometimes you can't find the 2D. My preference would be every multiplex that's got the screens for it, if you're offering a movie in 3D, offer it in 2D. Because I'll tell you what I do with my 9-year-old. And we see a lot of movies, obviously, because I'm in the business and she's a big movie lover. But she will pick whether or not she wants to go see 3D or 2D based on what she thinks of the movie. And she definitely wanted to see 1010 in 3D. We just saw that one. But the other kids' movies that are available in 3D, which she really wouldn't care if it were 3D or 2D, so we go to 2D instead. And I think that kind of choice is what we just have to keep available for our patrons. Otherwise, there will be, you know, a backlash against the price of 3D because if it's the only option on seeing a movie, people don't have a way out. So I definitely hear your concern.
Well, one of the things Roger Ebert said in a piece a couple of weeks back and why attendance is down or was down in 2011, one of his points, and we've touched on many of them, was the massively overpriced concessions. Now, I would imagine as the head of NATO, an organization that is, you know, a trade organization for movie theater owners, I would imagine you hear that quite a bit. So what is the response to hearing that?
Three responses. First, I would challenge the assumption statement they're massively overpriced. Is it more expensive to buy a candy bar or a bag of popcorn at a theater than it is at Walmart? Of course. But that's not the point. You don't compare the price of concessions to what you can get when you're taking it home because you're buying the concessions to eat them at the theater. Compare the concession prices at movie theaters with sports stadiums, with Broadway play performances, with any other form of out-of-home entertainment, and you'll see that they're very, very comparable. In fact, we're slightly cheaper than most of those other forms of entertainment. I spend, you know, as much taking my kids to a ball game or more on concessions as I do at the movie theater. So that's response number one, is you have to compare it in a fair universe with other concessions and experiences outside the home. The second response is, and people don't like to accept this, but the money that theater owners make on concessions keeps ticket prices from being even higher. About 22-23% of our gross revenues come from concessions, but over 40% of our net comes from concessions. We have to split that ticket price, you know, at hardly negotiated rates with the studios who own the IP and the movies. And so every dollar that comes in concessions is ours, whereas, you know, a big chunk of that ticket price is going to the studios. So the second response is, you know, if it weren't for concessions, our business model would be completely different. And the third response is, if people think the prices on the concessions are too high, don't buy them. We still love to have you come to the cinema and watch the movie. If that's what you can afford and you don't want to eat the concessions, we still want you to come through the door. So, you know, no one's required to buy a popcorn and a soda when they go to see the movie. It's totally the consumer's choice.
Well, John, as you can see, I'm a big supporter of the long-term health of movie going and the long-term trends. If we look at the last 2 years, though, we do see that, you know, it was in the context of the worst recession in 70 years. But again, you know, the last 2 years, ticket sales were lower than every year in the 2000s. So that's not a great thing. It's not a great way to start off a new decade. And we believe and know that there will be a bump up in ticket sales, especially with a recovering economy. But that's not a great thing. We've also looked at, you know, the premium pricing and movie going experiences. The one irony and the one thing I'd really like to send you off with is that despite all the money and expense paid to upgrade movie theaters, that we're having a lot of reports and a lot of problems with not taking full advantage of the money that they've spent to create the best possible projection and sound. We've gotten reports in Chicago and LA, and it's happened to me repeatedly where I go to a movie and people in the box office do not have the expertise or skills or the time and energy to switch from a 3D lens to a 2D lens, or they use the wrong bulb and all these other sort of technical things that, you know, moviegoers don't know or shouldn't care about. But the result is that movies are not being projected and shown in the best possible way. Now, in the 80s, I feel like George Lucas gave a really good kick in the pants to the theater owners with his THX stamp of approval. I think that was one of the elements that helped spur them to really create the great digital sound and image that we get a lot of times when we go to the movies. But I really think like NATO needs to work with its members and try and create some sort of certification, some sort of oversight to make sure that every theater that is a member of NATO is properly projecting and showing movies, to do some spot checking to make sure that they have employees on site who are skilled and have the ability and time to spend that hour or two it can take to switch the lens from a 2D film to a 3D film? Because I've gone to movies and seen a 2D film projected through a 3D lens, and it's murky and dark, and I complain, and they don't even understand what I'm talking about. And I think this is a really serious, serious issue that's been going on for a while, and I hope that NATO will consider, you know, taking the lead to try and self-police themselves and make sure that they don't, you know, squander all the money they've spent to upgrade these cinemas by letting technical issues keep them from taking full advantage of it.
Well, fair enough, and I'll agree with about 80% of your concluding point there. We are in a transitional phase. You know, like I said, we're about 65% of the way integrated on digital cinema right now. We got a lot of projectionists out there who are, like everybody else, neophytes at running the new systems. And there are about 160,000 theater employees, and you know, I've talked to quite a few of them as I travel across the country. And we're in a learning phase where they need to figure out fast, you know, how to best operate the new systems, because the new systems are powerful. The image is if projected properly, is better than it was in film. It lasts longer. It's more versatile, but it is more complicated. And we have to figure out, you know, how to keep that visual potential up. Brightness is a big issue. Bulbs are you know, expensive, but they go out faster in 3D and digital cinema than they did in film. So we're doing everything we can to improve those issues. We're looking at laser technologies as a potential for projection to replace the bulb problem. And we are involved in standard setting on all of these issues. There are lumens requirements, foot Lambert's requirements set by the Society of Motion Picture Television Engineers that we support. So, yes, we are driving to use this equipment that we paid a lot of money for to get the best possible visual image. Is NATO going to become a government that, you know, that polices our members and boots them from the industry if they don't comply? No. I mean, it's a free enterprise system, and it's a voluntary system, and I like my job and don't want them to fire me. But we're doing everything we can to encourage, you know, the best possible experience for our patrons on the screen. And after we've had another year or so under our belt with this digital cinema stuff, I think we'll probably be better at operating the technology in a way that really produces the optimal image more often than not. So that's what we're pushing for.
Well, John, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us today. It's always a pleasure to speak with you. And as always, you laid out your case quite convincingly.
Sperling and Michael, thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, guys.
Bye.
Bye.
Let's continue the conversation for a second, Sperling.
That's fine by me. I mean, as you know, this is a conversation we've been continuing now for more than 2 years. So,
well, when viewers come to the website and they look at the links, they'll see a wealth of information about box office and ticket sales and long-term trends. We've got information about DVD sales and home video and streaming and all that, and looking at the overall pie. And then we've got information about the worldwide box office. As people who listen to our show know, we had a record year worldwide, a record year internationally. So there's a lot of growth that's going to continue to happen. But I just want to lay to rest a few things that have been driving me crazy for so long. When you look at the long-term ticket sales and trends of the box office from the 70s to the 80s to the 90s and through the 2000s, would you concede that ticket sales, that attendance at the movies in North America has steadily increased decade by decade, that there's no long-term or even short-term decline in the number of people going to the movies, and it's keeping pace with the population growth?
Well, I would concede this.
I mean, that's why it's growing. It's basically keeping pace with, you know, people aren't going to the movies more, even though the ticket sales increase. It's just that there are more people around.
I would concede this, that ticket sales, of course, have gone up. They are not keeping up. But at the same time, if you look at the, well, two things. One,
I have looked at the population growth.
The population growth. So, and I'm trying to find it. This was me vamping while I was trying to find this information.
Well, the population in 1980 was 227 million people. The population in the 2000s was 281 million, and by 2010, it was 308 million people. Ticket sales have increased 30%. Population increased 25%, or if you measure from the very earliest to the very latest year, a 37%. So slightly lower, but if you average that over the decade, it's basically kept pace with the population growth.
Okay, well now.
And of course, people spend $10 billion at the box office, and they've been spending another $20 billion in North America buying movies at home. That's what makes the movie going holding steady even all the more remarkable.
Well, and you know, when you look at it at a broad swath that way, yes, it can tell that story, the story you just laid out there. What I would like to do is, from 1980 to 1990, there was a population increase of, or the 1980s through the 1990s, I should say. So those two decades, there was a population increase of 9.78%.
Well, it went from 227 million people to 249 million people.
Well,
an extra 22 million people.
Well, and so there's your 9.78%. At the same time, good news, there was ticket sales increase of 16.13%. So from the 1980s to the 1990s, more tickets were sold in the 1990s than in the 1980s. And that includes when you take population growth into account. Then you look at the 1990s and the 2000s. You take both of those decades into account, and you have a population increase of 13.15%. So call it like 13.25.
250 to 280 million people.
Right. You have ticket sale increase of 11.57%. So that is lower. And now I'd like to go year by year, because this is really, as you know, this was always my fear. And I think, you know, Mr. Fithian there kind of was explaining that, hey, you know what? It'll go down for a couple of years. It'll go up for a couple of years. Is that from 2000, when you had 5.0, you're the per capita of 5.06 here in North America, it rose in 2002 to 5.72 times.
Oh my God, this is confusing me and geeking out on like year to year and minute to minute breakdowns of how many times people went to the movies per person. The simple overall truth is that, you know, almost 13 billion tickets were sold in the 90s and 14.46 billion tickets were sold in the 2000s. And that every single, you know, 8 out of 10 years in the 2000s beat the best year of the 90s in number of tickets sold. So except for 2 years, they equaled or sold more tickets than in the single best year of the 90s, every single year of the 2000s.
So we're not talking about sales like a gross. We're talking about actual individual tickets being sold.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. More tickets were sold 8 out of 10 years in the 2000s than the single best year in the 90s. You know, I mean, you can talk about, are individuals going to movies 4.5 times as much as they were 2 years ago or something like that? Do people have other options? The population's grown. People have other things that they do. They spend twice as much buying DVDs and renting them and streaming them as they do going to the movies, but they still go to the movies. And the long-term trend is clear that it's kept basically pace with population. People continue to go to the movies. Now, the first 2 years of the 2010s are disastrous in a way. But we've had the worst recession in 70 years.
And it's 2 years. You know, yeah. I guess, again, you know, where I was going with the per caps is that from 2002 to today, the per cap per year has been trending down. And of course, that's what's alarming to me, is that we get to a point where people don't make a habit out of going to the movies, or they just don't, you know, it's not one of the things they do anymore.
But that's not borne out by the ticket sales and by the box office and by adjusting for inflation and for population growth. It's not borne out at all.
No, I think it's pretty widely known that per cap attendance, only in America, we're only talking about the US here,
and Canada has
decreased over since 2002. I mean, that's pretty much everybody kind of recognizes that throughout the industry. The question is,
I don't,
you know, are they spending more time watching DVDs?
2002 was the peak year of ticket sales in all of history. So when you're benchmarking your ticket sales compared to 2002, that's like saying box office is down from the highest year in history. That is not an intelligent statistic. When you say, my God, 2010 was lower than 2009, well, that's technically true. But the fact is, 2009 was the second highest grossing year in box office history. 2002, when we sold 1.57 billion tickets, is the absolute most number of tickets that have ever been sold in 1 year in history. You cannot use the peak year as a judge of what is the standard. You can't say, well, why don't we always equal or surpass the greatest year in ticket sales in history?
Well, why don't we take
crazy
a really
comparison?
Well, let's take a bad year. We, you know, 1995, 16 years ago, when, you know,
1.26 billion tickets were sold. Every single year in the 2000s was higher than that. Every year since then has been higher than that, including 2010 and 2011, 2 years that were, you know, affected by the worst recession in 70 years.
Well, okay, at that point in 1995, the per cap was 4.78. This last year, it was 3.97. So you have a drop of more than 1%, or one movie per person. And that's what I'm talking about, is you know, it's one of those things where, You might not notice it because it doesn't happen all at once, but little by little by little, all of a sudden, you're not selling any records anymore.
But the but that's not true. The population is growing dramatically in the U.S. You know, it is. And if some of the new additions or some of the people who get older don't go to the movies as much, it's not the end of the world. And when you can't look at – do you want every single American to go to 5 or 8 movies a year? Sure. Why not? That would be even better for the industry. Of course, if more people went to more movies all year long, if everybody went to one movie a month like they or one movie a week like they did in the 20s, of course, we'll never equal the pace that people went to the movies in the 1920s and 30s. That was the event. People went every week. The number of people who went to the movies was
– You know what the per cap was in 19 – pick any year in the 30s or 40s, any year.
1934,
the per cap, guess what it was?
10.
17.87.
Yeah, exactly. That's why we don't go past the 70s and really the 60s when we look at box office and attendance and all that. Because A, we don't have great numbers for the 20s, 30s, 40s. It's very complicated. And B, it's a different era. It's just an absolutely different era. So yes, you're right. It would be great and box office would be astronomically bigger if everybody went to 8 movies a year, but they don't. And that's okay. But you can't say because they're not going to 8 movies a year that the box office is collapsing or people don't go to the movies or that ticket sales have fallen apart and movie theaters are about to shutter up and die. It's not the last picture show we're talking about here.
Well,
movie
I've never
going
said
is
that.
Incredibly – oh my God, it's a great movie. Movie going is very,
no,
very
no, no.
robust.
I said I've never said that movie theaters were dying.
People say it all the time.
That's it's an industry I work in, as you know.
People
I mean,
say it all the time. Okay. You know, they say constantly, oh my God, nobody's going to the movies anymore. It's 2 down years in a row. It's the end of movies. People say it constantly. That's why we talk about it all the time.
Okay, well, why don't we move on since I'm sure that our listeners at this point have either stopped listening or have fallen asleep.
But do you agree? I mean, you can talk about per cap and you wish more people would go to more movies every single day. But do you agree that ticket sales and box office and all that stuff keep pace with inflation, keep pace with the population growth, and are very robust?
They keep pace with inflation. They are – the ticket sales increase year to year for the – you know. For the most part, you know, there are
ups and downs, of course. But decade by decade, there's no question.
Population growth, that's what remains to be seen. So I would say yes to everything but population growth.
But you don't see anybody who tells you, oh, movies are falling apart, people don't go to the movies anymore, is ridiculous.
I think that people who say that are, you know, that the sky is also falling on them. So
And if you look at the overall pie of DVD sales and Blu-ray and streaming and Netflix and then the worldwide market, movies are so much more profitable than they were 40 years ago. It's not even funny.
Well, I don't know if we can speak to profit because, of course, they cost more to make. So I guess we'd have to know like how much money was spent making them.
Well, but they only made like $3, 4, or $5 billion at the box office and they didn't have DVD sales. They had very little international. So all that stuff is extra. So box office has doubled and they've now got an extra $20 billion overseas and an extra $20 billion on DVD and Blu-ray. I'm going to guess that $50 billion is a lot bigger increase than the budgets of a movie.
Right, but at the same time, you know, these big budget movies that used to cost, you know, $50 million. Oh my gosh, how could a movie cost $50 million? Well, now they cost $150 to $250. So,
but and also we should say that studios are not pumping in more movies to try and bump up the. It's not that they're releasing more movies. There are fewer movies. They're expensive. They're a mix of big and small budget. But it's, you know, we're looking at a fairly steady amount of theatrical distribution over the past few decades. You know,
yes.
A couple hundred movies from the major studios.
Yes, no, and they are going down, not up, because they're, you know...
Modestly, though. You know, big studios tend to release, like, you know, 10 to 20, 25 movies a year, depending on the studio and where they are in their lifespan, you know.
No, you had Disney saying, okay, we used to release, you know, between, you know, 15 and 22 movies a year. We're going to release between 10 and 12. You had Warner Brothers saying, well, we're probably only going to release 15 instead of 24 movies this year. So, you know, basically you have these large studios owned by conglomerates who are saying, you know what? When we make a movie and it's going to cost $125 million, we need to kind of guarantee that there's going to be an audience there. So we're going to make fewer films and base them on kind of known entities. So let's base it off of a comic book or a bestseller. And so that's really what you're seeing happening.
All right. Well, we've covered this to death, but I hope nobody will question anymore that ticket sales and box office grosses, that if you look bigger picture rather than year to year, that things are going very well.
You know what's not going well?
What's that?
Is our timing here.
Maybe there should be a special episode devoted only to box office.
Who knows?
Let's jump right to Big Deal and Big Whoop.
Well, okay, if you want to skip over television news and music news for this week, and maybe we'll touch on it next week.
Yeah.
What do you say? Okay. So I'm skipping down here to Big Deal or Big Whoop. Wow, we have a lot of box office news. Our show notes this week.
Somebody just groaned. Somebody just drove off the highway. Children are crying. Mommy, please turn off this boring show.
Well, you know, Big Deal or Big Whoop is our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, Spin Magazine reduces album reviews to tweets. Spin Magazine has decided to cover a lot more albums a lot more quickly. Instead of writing 3 and 4 and 5 paragraph reviews of every album they can, Spin has decided to just tweet 140 characters on as many different releases as possible. They'll still talk at length about 20 albums or 30 albums in their magazine each month and devote even more space to the best albums. But tweets are about all, you know, they're going to tweet about almost every artist. Big Deal or Big Whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big whoop. I mean, it's nice to provide extra coverage for albums that they wouldn't cover otherwise if it was an expansion of what they do. But if it means a reduction in the amount of real estate that they provide to thoughtful, intelligent music reviews, that's a shame because there are a lot of great albums out there that deserve attention. They also made a really weird comment and assertion. They said, you know what? It doesn't really matter critics anymore. Our power is so much reduced. Used to be we got the albums first, but now you can listen to them the same time we do because you're listening to leaks or you're listening to new copies. And so since you can listen to it yourself and make up your own mind, why do you care what we think? And I'm saying, well, that doesn't make any sense because the point of critic is not that they get to hear it first. The point is that they help us sort through the tens of thousands of albums that come out and help us find the ones that are really good. That's why I read critics, not because they got to hear it before me.
Right. It's so kind of like curation. It's you're looking at them as kind of an educated curator.
Right, and that's more important than ever, but they seem to think that it's devalued because they don't get to listen to the new Jay-Z album a week before I do.
I think really what they're saying is, you know, who cares about critics? No, who cares about your critics is really the issue there. Because if you look, you know, in an article on, I think it was Digital Music News, I was reading how, well, critics do matter. The right critics matter. So if you get a great review on Pitchfork, well, your band gets booked all over the country. But
yeah, I mean, because of the amount of TV shows and books and movies and albums that are out there, it, you know, critics and people to filter all that out for you is more important than ever. Filter.
Yeah. Well, speaking of which, here's a story for you. Bookstore sales are down or were down in November. I think it's the end of books and bookstores. No, just kidding. Final sales figures are coming in for November at bookstores. Individual stores had some great news this holiday season, thanks to the disappearance of Borders, the second biggest bookstore chain in the country. But as you might expect, overall sales were down. Sales dropped a steep 8.6% from the previous year, following a 6.6% decline in October. But how do they do decade over decade? Big Deal or Big Whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. The book industry has reacted well to ebooks. They're making them available easily and smartly to consumers, which is the right way to go. Let people buy books the way they want to read them. But losing the second biggest bookstore chain in the country, that's just one less place people can walk in and look at books and buy books. I have no place to walk in and look at music, and I don't buy as much music as I used to. The same thing is going to happen to books, and there's no way to replace all those bookstores around the country with books on display.
Downton Abbey is actually a hit. The British drama Downton Abbey, which won a Golden Globe last night, is a pop culture success. Publishers are rushing books into print that might interest people fascinated with stately homes and British aristocracy. And season 2 of the series debuted on PBS to strong ratings. It attracted 4.2 million viewers, doubling the channel's usual primetime audience of 2 million, with presumably another 25% catching it on DVR for perhaps 5.2 million viewers. By PBS standards, that's a blockbuster. Big Deal or Big Whoop, Michael?
I say it's a big whoop. I like the show. It's fun, silly soap. It's no Upstairs Downstairs. I mean, the original. But incredibly overhyped. The New York Times, you should do better, had an article saying it debuted to record ratings last season. I'm like, no. And I looked it up. I'm like, it did? I looked up. No, it was the third highest miniseries in the last like 6 or 7 years, which is great, but it's not a record rating. And the overhyping of the show and acting as if it's, you know, a show that all of America is watching, when in fact it's a solid hit for PBS, but that means it wouldn't even be in the top 30 if it was on a major network, or in the top 15 if it was on cable. You know, the overplaying of it has been annoying me for quite a while.
But you know,
it's fun and I watch it.
That's PR for you. I mean, they're doing their job.
But no, that's not PR. That's the New York Times, who should know better, and other news outlets that should know better and not swallow the PR. That's what I'm talking about. Of course PBS is hyping it up.
Yeah.
And it's a success for them.
Right. Now, here's a story, another story for you, Michael. All these Big Deal or Big Whoops are just for you. Remember that movie you didn't like?
Avatar.
Yes. Well, guess what? You won't have to see the sequel, at least not for the next 4 years. As well, you're going to have to wait a little bit longer to see that live-action Star Wars TV show. You shouldn't hold your breath for director James Cameron's sequel to Avatar. The movie, which reportedly spends a lot of time amid the oceans of Pandora, was supposed to come out December of 2014, with a third film due 1 year after that. But producer Jon Landau says it is at least 4 years away. So that would mean, what, like a 7-year gap between the original and its first sequel? No word on why. The reason for the delay in a live-action Star Wars television series is a little bit clearer. It would be too expensive. No kidding. What a shock. Lucas reportedly has some 50 scripts written, where he had some 50 scripts written for the drama dubbed Star Wars Underworld. They are meant to take place between Revenge of the Sith and the original Star Wars film, but will not include main characters from the movies. That does not shock me at all.
But maybe Boba Fett.
That's true, yeah. Lucas's plans seem to be pie in the sky, with he and his team saying it could spin off into four different shows following four different characters involving drugs and prostitution, because let's face it, when you think of Star Wars, you think about drugs and prostitution. At least I always did. And, you know, compare it to the he's comparing it to The Godfather. But it's not happening for years until technology makes it cheap enough to do the shows right. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal for Avatar and a big whoop for Star Wars. Avatar is obviously a huge film. Everybody wants to see it. All the theaters, all the students, you know, they want to make this baby happen. I actually had to look up the name of Pandora because I was worried I had remembered it wrong. I'm like, well, I go, isn't that the music service? That's a big deal because that's 2016. And believe me, it's the biggest film of all time. So people want that sequel. Star Wars, I think George Lucas is out of his mind. He did do some good television, Young Indiana Jones. But the more he describes and deals with this TV show, the crazier and stupider it sounds. And you know what? Battlestar Galactica looked great. I don't understand why he doesn't think he can do a good sci-fi TV series. I think the problem that he has is exactly the problem with the last three movies he's made from Star Wars, is that he's confusing technology with storytelling. And
that's
you do
right.
not need state-of-the-art technology to tell a great story on television. In fact, worrying about that is exactly the wrong way around.
Well, yeah, and you mentioned Battlestar Galactica. I was going to say, yes, they had some wonderful establishing shots of ships,
it looked great.
Rattling through space. But then they cut inside the ship and told a story, and that right there would be the weakness. what I think would be funny is, if George Lucas were able to make this, that when they repeated each episode, that it was just a little different, that he went and tweaked something or made it into 3D. You know, like he was never really done with each episode.
Never see the same episode twice.
Exactly.
Oh my God.
The Electronic Slush Pile has scored a deal for an unknown author. The Penguin website bookcountry.com was initially mocked as almost a scam. They encourage aspiring writers to post samples of their work, share comments about other authors, and create a warm online community for writers, because that's usually when two writers read each other's works, they never criticize, ever. Oh, and if no one publishes your stuff, here's how Penguin can create an ebook for you for a modest fee. In essence, it's a big slush pile, a collection of unsolicited manuscripts from unknown authors. Yes, once in a career, you might discover J.K. Rowling. Most of the time, you discover there are a lot of people who can't write but believe they can. But the unlikely happened. A literary agent read one person's samples, liked them enough to ask for more, signed her up as a client, and scored a deal with a paperback imprint of Penguin called Ace. So dreams really can come true on the internet. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big whoop as far as this particular approach to finding new authors. It happened. Great. It could happen again. You needed that agent to go in there and pile through it and find the diamond in the rough. But it's no better or worse than piling through that slush pile that piles up at every, publisher and agent's office around the country. So it makes it maybe a little more convenient, but it also means you've got, instead of 100, manuscripts staring at you, 1,000 or 5,000. So I don't see it really being a great source of talented writers. But you find authors in that slush pile there. There's been an author in the UK who's had a big hit with fan fiction that she wrote for a Twilight website, and that's been pulled and turned into a book and been a big success. So, with all these new online ways, there are ways for people to stick their heads up and get noticed.
Well, maybe what they're trying to do is crowdsource their slush pile, basically let all these other people go through it. And if, 1,000 or 2,000 or 3,000 people say it's good, then maybe we'll take a look at it.
Good point.
Hulu expands into original programming. That's right, Hulu, the website that lets you watch network shows when you were too dumb to set your DVR.
Ouch.
Yeah, that's kind of me, actually. Well, it's creating more original content. It has returning reality show A Day in the Life, where filmmaker Morgan Spurlock follows around a celebrity like Richard Branson or Will.i.am of the Black Eyed Peas. Director Richard Linklater is involved with and will direct at least 6 episodes of Up to Speed, which goes to famous historic destinations and looks for the oddball feature or angle that most people usually miss. Finally, the original drama Battleground follows campaign workers involved with the third-party candidacy of a politician in the battleground state of Wisconsin. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop in a way. Everybody has to do this. You have to have original programming, even when you're a site that's basically offering the programming of others. You need to give people a reason to come to your cable channel, to your website again and again and again. And investing in original programming is a great way to do that. It can really, one show like Mad Men can completely change the fortunes of a channel like AMC. However, I do think the guy who is speaking for Hulu needs to work on his hype ability. His name is Andy Forsell. He's a senior VP of original content. And he was talking about the TV show Battleground. And he said, "We think the show has the potential to be something that people say, this is one of the best things I've seen in the last couple of weeks."
You know, I think it's a big deal only because, you know, Hulu has to turn to Fox and NBC and ABC and say, give us your programming. We'd like to cut a deal with you. Well, if they're competing for shows.
But they're not really, you know, there's way too, I don't think that's a competitive thing. You know, I just don't, because everybody's competing with everybody. And the idea that they're going to have original programming, they're suddenly going to be competing with ABC to snag stars. I don't see it happening. It's been happening for so long between HBO and Showtime and all these people who work together with cable providers. And, you know, Time Warner Cable has a local radio news, a local news show, 24-hour news channel, New York One. Are they in competitors with, you know, MSNBC? Sure. But you know what? It's just, there's so many complications in the world that everybody's competing with everybody inside their own company and outside. It's just a fact of life.
Well, also, if something does well on Hulu, then, you know, maybe NBC, Fox, and ABC get first crack at it. Yeah, precisely. Exactly. You know, also, you know, Hulu, 60% growth and 1.5 million subscribers to Hulu Plus now. So that's growing.
60% growth over what? Last year or 2010? Or what is that?
Oh, I never should.
In amount of watching?
I have no idea. I never should have said anything because...
Well, they have some numbers that they're happy about. Good for Hulu.
Exactly. Well, that actually concludes Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week. And moves us right along into Inside Baseball. How do you like how I'm whipping us along here, Michael?
Great job.
Well, now, Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. With John Fithian, we were talking about piracy a little bit. We probably could have asked him about SOPA or PIPA. And if you don't know what that is, SOPA stands for the Stop Online Piracy Act. That is a...
Arg!
Yeah, well, not that kind of piracy. However, you couldn't download a movie legally if you, you can't download a movie legally now anyway, unless you're paying for it. But this is a bill that basically wants to help prevent the piracy of copyrighted material. Over in the Senate, there's the Protect IP Act.
The same idea.
Sponsored by Patrick Leahy. The big problem with both of these bills is that they do this thing called DNS blocking. So effectively, it would create two internets, one that inside the United States and the one that the rest of the world sees. The problem with that is that it's really insecure, because if you're spoofing a DNS or you're falsifying a DNS, a domain name, server, and IP address, then how do you know when you go to Wells Fargo to do your online banking or you go to Amazon to buy something that you're actually at the real website? So there's a huge security problem here. And what happens over the weekend or last Friday? Three members of the Obama administration, these are three tech members, so the chief technology officer of the country, basically said, no, we're not going to support this at all.
In their present form.
In their present form. Yes, that is true.
And that is in the face of, you know, the Hollywood and a lot of major players who were real big donors of Obama and support him in his first election that strongly, strongly supported wanting these bills to go through. So it was, there are obviously also big donors who didn't want it to go through. But the people who were opposed to the bills were not people who were pro-piracy or were competitors with the Hollywood or anything like that. They were just people in the tech industry who were saying, this is a really bad idea. And they finally got through by, you know, common sense, thank God, prevailed a little bit, where they said, look, we don't, you know, we want, we, you know, they don't even want people to be downloading thousands of illegal movies because it screws up the internet and slows down and, pardon me, slows stuff down and all that. So, you know, they don't, they, if they have a dog in the fight, it's probably anti-piracy. You know, they have to deal with software theft and people stealing video games. So people in the internet world, they, some people act as if they don't care about copyright. They don't care about intellectual property. They don't care if people are stealing movies and TV shows. I think they do. But in general, they were just saying, look, from a technology point of view, this is a dreadful idea. And it won't stop piracy at all because the workarounds were already spreading through the internet of simple ways to go around this DNS blocking thing.
Right.
So
I mean, basically,
it wasn't going to help at all. As always, the industry, you know, Hollywood and other people create these bizarre technological fixes to try and fight a problem that don't work and just punish the average consumer.
Yeah, I mean, Patrick Norton called it the equivalent, and he's the host of Techzilla, a tech podcast. He compared it to using a nuclear bomb to kill a field mouse. You might wind up with some collateral damage. It might not be the best weapon to use. And just a real quick technical explanation, DNS, think of it as the internet's phone book. So you type in Amazon.com, but really the way to get to the server hosting Amazon.com is to type in an IP address. Well, you don't
have to... phone, it's like their phone number, their address.
Right.
Yeah, it goes right to them and every person has just one.
Right, correct. And so there are all of these domain name servers out there that says, oh, Amazon.com, no problem. That's 209.16.138.2. So we'll send you there. Well, if you say, oh, actually, we're going to send you to this false IP address, the second you break DNS, you break the way the internet works. And Vint Cerf, one of the forefathers and founders of the internet, and he wrote this long article or long letter to Congress saying, hey, you know what? This really doesn't work. Instead, maybe you guys could follow the money and maybe try to stem piracy that way. Because you're right, Michael, nobody, including us, including you know, people who you know are big internet tycoons, they hate online piracy because it does take away from everything that they're trying to do.
But I should make clear that that is not the only problem with these bills. The listeners who called in and said that I was wrong, they were right. These bills did not have proper due process. They did not have proper protection for freedom of speech. The way the bills were worded in both houses, I believe, if I was on a website saying, gee, look at these horrible pirate sites, it's terrible how easy it is to get movies, and I provided a link showing you about the problem of rampant piracy, they could shut down my site. Or if somebody had a website like the New York Times where somebody in a comment section put a link to something that the Times didn't even approve of or deal with, that could cause the site to be shut down. And there was no due process, no formal, you know, procedure for dealing with this or appeals if it wasn't properly done. It was a mess on many, many levels.
Right. And well, there was due process, but it was a due process that nobody had any access to. So it was like, you know,
Well, it was the due process of the studios go to the Justice Department and say, we want you to shut this down. The Justice Department says, okay.
Well, they go to a court and the judge says, well, if you say so.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. That's not due process in my mind.
Right.
So there are still a lot of things to pay attention on these two bills because they're not going to go away. They are going to come back. But hopefully they'll be a lot smarter technically and fix all these other problems as well.
No, but Patrick Leahy is the sponsor for Protect IP, and he was the sponsor for COICA, which Protect IP was based on, and it was shot down last year in 2010. Well, guess what? Some of his major campaign contributors were Warner Brothers, Time Warner, GE, Disney. I'm forgetting
right.
all of them.
But there's nothing you can do. Chuck Schumer is my senator, one of my two senators, and he's in the pocket of Wall Street, and he's fought deregulation of Wall Street, and he supported SOPA because the big industry heavyweights that he got money from told him to. And there's nothing I can do about it because even if I don't support him, he's never going to lose his office. As long as he wants to be senator, he will be senator the way the system is structured right now.
Well, hopefully we didn't bore you to death too much today.
No, don't say that. It was fascinating.
Yes, no, I'm kidding, because of course I knew we were going to run long today. We have been wanting to get John Fithian from the National Association of Theater Owners on the show for a very long time, and I was very happy that he was able to join us today to talk about really the health and status of movie going in the modern age.
Which is strong.
Yes. And speaking of strong, we strongly recommend that you subscribe to the show on iTunes, the Zune Marketplace, or on Stitcher, or your RSS reader, or any podcatcher. In fact, why don't you go and rate and review our shows on iTunes, the Zune Marketplace, or any place you can rate and review our show. We suggest 5 stars, by the way. Now, you can find links to two ways to subscribe to us or ways to follow us on Twitter. Our username is Showbiz Sandbox, and on Facebook, our username is a little bit different. It's Showbiz Sandbox. You can find those links, as well as links to all of the stories that we've talked about in today's episode, on our website. Guess what it is?
Showbiz Sandbox.
ShowbizSandbox.com. That's right. That's also where you'll find ways to email us. Dirt@showbizsandbox.com is the email address to send off your missives to. You can call us, and our toll-free phone number is 888-567-SAN. That's 888-567-7263. We're running a little long today, so we can't read any listener email or play any listener voicemail, but possibly next week. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, who is mgmt.com. Michael has a website. It's michaelgiltz.com. And as John Fithian mentioned, you can find some of my writing on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.